Stevenson, whose latest novel is Seven Eves. This is the ninth novel, I believe. There's also Anathem, Cryptonomicon, Snow Crash, a collection of essays and short stories called Some Remarks. Seven Eves is a very long novel about the end of the world and the beginning of the world at the same time. I understand the premise of the novel began in 2006 when you were working at Blue Origin. So what is Blue Origin, and how did Seven Eves come from that?
Blue Origin is a private commercial space company funded by Jeff Bezos. I was working there early in its kind of formative years when it was looking for things to do and looking at possible different strategies. And so I was trying to contribute some useful ideas. And one of the things I was looking at was the problem of space junk. So humans have been going into space long enough by this point that we have littered the low Earth orbit with spent rocket boosters and dead satellites and things that astronauts dropped when they were on their spacewalks. So there's a lot of stuff kind of zooming around up there at very high speed. And every so often, two of those objects at random will just happen to collide with each other. And when they do, they shatter and make more pieces, smaller pieces, that go spraying out in new random orbits. And the idea has been raised by kind of serious scientists that that could snowball. You know, in theory, you know, the more pieces, the more collisions, and the more collisions, the more pieces. And there could be kind of an exponential blow-up that would leave so much crap floating around in orbit that we would not be able to go into space the way we've become accustomed to. So that wasn't really a very useful idea commercially, but it was, from a novelistic standpoint, kind of interesting to me and kind of lodged in my brain. And I had been sort of thinking for since I was a kid about maybe doing a space arc novel. That's kind of a subgenre of science fiction. And I had read one when I was a kid. I can't remember the name of the author, but it made a big impression on me. And I thought, well, okay, space junk isn't enough to trigger building a space arc, but if it happened on a much, much, much larger scale, then maybe that sort of ticking clock thing could be the premise for a space arc book.
I understand that you began pitching the idea before you began writing the novel. What were you looking at that point?
Well, I had some sketches of it written down. You know, here's what this would look like. Here's what that would look like. Here are the different kind of phases in the story. And I couldn't really settle on what was the right way to present it. Was this an idea for a movie? Was it an idea for a TV series or a game or a book or what? So I kind of tried everything, but every time I took another swing at it, the idea got a little bit more fully developed, and I got, you know, more stuff kind of piling up. This is kind of like an intellectual dust bunny. Nobody knows how dust bunnies start, but one day you look under your bed and that thing's been there for years, just getting bigger while I wasn't paying attention, and now it's the size of a weasel. This was one of those, except with just stuff accumulating on my hard drive. And finally, a couple of years ago, I just said, what the hell, I'm just going to sit down and write this thing as a book, and then at least it's out there, you know, and then what happens will happen.
I recall, I think when I interviewed you for ReamD, you must have already been starting on the book at that point, because I think you made mention that you had a female protagonist.
Actually, if I said that then, I was probably talking about a different book. That book is one that I got some distance into, and I kind of put a pin in it for a while because it looks like turning into a much bigger project, a big series like The Baroque Cycle, and that's great, and I want to write it, and I will write it, but it takes a long time to do one of those. Like The Baroque Cycle took me like 7 years or something, and I kind of felt like maybe I should clear the decks and get Seven Eves out the door and maybe some other stuff out the door as well before plunging back into that huge thing.
Neal Stephenson, you have this idea, and to create the space debris or maybe to create the end of the world, you decide to blow up the moon. How did that come about?
It's a pretty simple calculation. It's not even a calculation. The space debris exponential blow-up thing looks like it might work, but I'm going to need a lot more stuff if it's going to be big enough to blow up the world. Where am I going to get that much stuff? Well, the only real candidate is the moon, so the moon has to go.
But you decided not to let us know exactly how the moon blew up.
I considered some different takes on that, some different approaches to it, and eventually made up my mind that this thing ought to begin in medias res, as the saying goes, and just let's go. Let's just start.
So you've got the moon blown up. You've got the pieces getting scattered. And at that point, you know the world's going to end. I would gather you've already done enough research on that. But the next question is, how much time is necessary, and what exactly will the race do to survive? And I guess that's where all the research and work first began coming in.
Yeah, research is a pretty fine word for it. It's kind of me making stuff up, but doing so in a way that's informed by having been a space geek my whole life. So I've just been accumulating random knowledge about space since I was about 3 years old, watching Gemini launches in front of a great big black and white television. There was enough there, you know, sort of like a camel storing water in its hump. I kind of had enough to go on for a ways and get fairly deep into the book before having to stop and do anything you would really call research. But then I started talking to various people I know who are in that business, in that world, and was able to get a lot of useful insights, I guess, and directions from those people.
The arclets, the blow-up arclets that circle the cloud arc and Izzy the space station, where did they come from?
That's my guess as to what we would come up with if this happened tomorrow and we just had to go immediately with what we've got. We didn't have time to do radical new designs. So we've already got the International Space Station, and we've got rockets that can launch stuff to it, and we've got launch pads, and, you know, everything's there. You know, one approach would be to just keep adding more stuff onto the International Space Station, but the problem there is that it's kind of an all-the-eggs-in-one-basket approach, and if that got hit by a rock, then maybe that's not the way to do it. So the idea of sending up a whole lot of separate rockets lends itself to a kind of swarm approach where each rocket would carry a quasi-independent vehicle that could kind of fly around. And I don't know if you've ever seen like a nature video of fish swarms where they move in a very tight bunch, but if a predator comes through, they kind of part and they make a big hole through the middle of the swarm, and the predator shoots through, doesn't catch any fish. And then in its wake, the fish all sort of close back in together and form back into the swarm. So that was kind of the visual metaphor that I was working from on how the cloud arc might work.
They eventually find an asteroid, Amalthea. Does that asteroid actually exist?
There actually is something out there called by that name, but it's not this one, right? So there's only so many names from classical mythology that you can use, and I wanted to use that one, Amalthea, because it's pretty. I like the word, and it actually has a mythological connection. Amalthea was the goat from which the gods suckled. So it was kind of a nurturing sort of presence in Greek mythology. You know, one of the things where I just departed from scientific correctness in this book is where I just stole that name from some real asteroid that is out there somewhere.
Well, obviously, as a novelist, you don't want to make this a technical manual of what life is like in space. You've got to create a story, which means you have to begin looking at how an apocalypse would affect mankind. And in that regard, you made an interesting choice, which is that things don't fall apart. People keep going to work, even though they've got 2 years to live.
Call me naive, maybe, but when I read history, and I read about wars and catastrophes and so on, the pattern that I see is that people in situations like that, tend to rise to the occasion. They tend to kind of pull up their socks and stay calm and find some way to make themselves useful. And I didn't want to write a book in which everyone just loses their junk and goes crazy. It turns into chaos, because that's not actually what I see in the real world in situations like this. And also, I wanted the emphasis to be on the people who are in space, because those are the people that we're going to follow.
Neal Stephenson, two of the major characters, one is a character named Doob, who reminded me of Neil deGrasse Tyson or perhaps Carl Sagan.
Mm-hmm.
And the other is the president, Julia, mm-hmm. who I guess is kind of Hillary, I'm not sure.
I'm resistant to trying to draw direct connections between fictional characters and real people. I don't see any resemblance at all between Hillary and Julia. And in a way, it's just an unfortunate chronological accident that this book came out at the moment that Hillary's ramping up her presidential campaign. But I realize people will probably draw the connection anyway. And then Doob is a science popularizer, but also a legitimate scientist. So he has that in common, as you say, with Carl Sagan and Neil deGrasse Tyson and others. You know, at any given time, it seems like we have got one person whose role in our society is to be the legit scientist, a real, honest-to-God scientist, who also is capable of speaking to the public about science. It's the person who's the host of Cosmos or who goes on the Today Show, you know, to talk about sciencey stuff. It was obvious to me in writing the book that if this happened tomorrow, that person would suddenly become more important. That person would suddenly become maybe the most important person in the world. And so it felt like it would be wrong to write the book without having that person in it and telling their story.
And then the story continues, which means that even after they get up in space, they have to survive, which brings the politics into it, and it also brings in the actual effects of what happens to avoid moon rocks and where are they going to go. Did that come organically as you were thinking about it? Did ideas come to you?
Well, I had a general notion of kind of a split forming different factions within the Cloud Arc, and that split would be rooted in legit scientific questions. I mean, there's not always a clear answer. You don't always know definitively what the right thing to do is. There's always room for disagreement, and there seems to be something in human nature where disagreement kind of spirals up and feeds on itself. So I kind of knew that was going to be the general shape of it, and that there was going to be kind of a split along those lines, and then actually telling the story involved kind of figuring out the details of what happens when.
The most destructive element in the life in outer space is something called Spacebook, which of course is Facebook. But it brings up something that you do talk about elsewhere, which is the corrosive effect of social media.
The book has been out for 2 or 3 days, so I'm still pretty new at this. I'm still just beginning to hear people's reactions to it, and there's always surprises when you do that. And one of the surprises so far is how much people are keying on that. I'm not disagreeing with it. It's interesting to me how much people are picking up on that aspect of it, and it makes me suspect that at some level lots of people right now are asking themselves kind of hard questions about social media and the way we behave on social media and what it's doing to our society. It's an important plot point, but it's not huge. But it wouldn't resonate as much with people. And lately we've been seeing specific examples of exceptionally bad behavior around social media that I think have sensitized people to this topic.
Well, it also means, and you've talked about this, Neal Stephenson, it also means for you as a writer, you need to be on it, but as you said in one interview, you don't want to get obsessed by it because then you can't write.
It's a funny balancing act. I mean, you can't write or really do anything productive unless you have long stretches of time when you're not distracted. But you can't ignore social media. It's just a normal part of the job today. And so I've got a Twitter feed and all the rest of that apparatus up and running. You have to ask yourself every day, what's the right amount of attention to pay to it?
Well, I'm just curious, going back many, many years, even perhaps before Facebook, for you as someone who thought about various issues concerning the future, read a lot of science fiction, was anything like social media in some form, was that ever in the back of your mind, or do we have Zuckerberg and company to just thank for something that came out of the blue, and I'm not necessarily using the word thank?
It came out of the blue for me. I can't take any credit at all for seeing that one coming. I remember, Heinlein in some of his novels in the 60s and 70s was pretty trenchant in his criticisms of mass media, of television reporters and that kind of thing. But this is new. I mean, science fiction in general has had trouble anticipating developments in the world of IT and media. Science fiction was pretty good at rockets and space stations, because that's a predictable path of technological development. But when you're talking about IT and the Internet, the human factor is so large that it's very difficult for people to see these things coming.
William Gibson once said, "Neuromancer, I didn't get cell phones."
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, exactly.
In talking about this book in Gizmodo, you did say that rocket technology was ahead of its time in the 60s, and then tech got really too far ahead, and now you think they're starting to come together?
The historical trajectory of World War II followed by the Cold War caused just staggering resources of money and technical talent to be thrown at rockets and space transportation. It was a matter of national survival for all of the great powers for many years. I do think that rockets got way out ahead of where they would have been as a result of that. And then rockets, in a weird way, kind of spawned information technology, in that integrated circuits had to be invented to make rockets work. And then suddenly the pendulum swung back the other way, and all of the kinds of smart people who would have been working on rockets and hydrogen bombs in the 50s and 60s were doing tech startups and doing things related to computers and IT, to a degree that now, you know, our infrastructure is broken and old and kind of stagnant. We're starting to see cases where, you know, the Elon Musks of the world, who've made their pile from IT-related stuff, are kind of turning back to the world of infrastructure and building physical stuff and applying some of what's been learned and some of the new tools that we have to attacking those problems.
Neil Stephenson, let's get back to the second half of Seven Eves, which takes place 5,000 years later after the first part. Was that always part of the plan? How did that come into the story?
Yeah, that was always part of the plan. I was unsure exactly how to roll that out and tried a number of approaches, but what we ended up deciding was to make a significant chunk of the book be an exploration of that future world. I had an idea of the kind of the architecture of the society, the physical situation they were going to be living in, what was going to be going on the Earth, which is now sort of being refurbished, re-terraformed. And so it was just a question of how much, you know, how deep to get in telling that story.
That required a completely new way of viewing what at least the people in outer space would be like. And it came up that something called epigenetics plays a role. I've never heard the term before.
Well, I was taught, and you were probably taught, that there's this thing called DNA, and it's present in every cell in your body, and it has a code that tells the whole story of who you are. And if you know what that code is, if you can sequence the DNA, then you pretty much know everything there is to know about an organism, what it's going to look like, how it's going to behave. It turns out that it's way more complicated than that. those genes may all be present, but some of them may be expressed or suppressed or turned on or off depending on complicated environmental circumstances. So the field of epigenetics is a relatively new one, and science fiction writers love that kind of thing because it's new enough that we can kind of freely make stuff up without fear of direct contradiction.
Well, there's also a quote from you that when you're talking about Star Trek and things like that, you're talking about aliens who kind of look human and speak English, and then you can posit that, hey, they're us.
It's true of many fantasy and science fiction worlds that they're populated by these humanoid races that are clearly kind of like people, but they've got certain differences in appearance and kind of different abilities and behavior traits. In Tolkien, you've got elves and dwarves and orcs and so on, and in, say, Star Trek, you've got Vulcans and Romulans and Ferengis and others. So that is a staple of nearly all science fiction and fantasy. I think that's kind of extraordinary, and I wanted to spend a little time kind of interrogating that and trying to figure out what we're really talking about when we populate our most popular fictional universes with those kinds of races.
You have a character named Kath 2 who becomes Kath 3 after falling asleep. Where did that come from?
Well, this is a sub-race of the humans. Its sort of superpower, if you will, is the ability to exploit epigenetics in a direct way. And so they're hooked up in such a way that from time to time, in response to a trauma perhaps or a change in their circumstances, they will undergo an epigenetic shift and turn into a different person. And when they do, they change the number that's at the end of their name. And they lose a lot of their memories, and they change a lot of their basic personality traits. They look different and kind of metamorphose into a different person.
Well, they don't seem to have any fear of doing this. I mean, Kath, too, isn't afraid of dying in that sense.
Yeah, well, they've come to accept that it might happen, and so they kind of order their lives accordingly. So they make friends, they have social lives, but it's all somewhat transient based on the expectation that all of those friends and all of that social life may suddenly go away.
And then you've got A Ring Around the World. And, of course, I think of Ringworld by Larry Niven. And I guess that movie with Jodie Foster, Elysium. So I guess you were drawing on that?
There's no need to draw on anything for that. We've already got in orbit right now today geosynchronous satellites. That's where you get your DirecTV. All that stuff is coming from satellites that hang directly above the equator in orbits that are timed to match the rotation of the Earth. So all that's going on here is simply taking that idea, and instead of it being a bunch of communication satellites, it's a bunch of habitats that are tens of kilometers long and can support hundreds of thousands of people each, and they all hang up there in a kind of ring-shaped formation high above the Earth's equator.
Then you've got something called the Cradle, and I won't talk about where that came from, but it's a giant, I guess, piece of rock that sits on a tether and floats.
It hangs on the end of a tether that dangles down from geosynchronous orbit. It's connected to the orbital ring by an elevator, so you can go back and forth, and it dangles down into the Earth's atmosphere. It can move around, it can be dragged around the equator, and it can settle down into sockets that have been constructed that match its physical shape. So if you happen to be living around one of those sockets, from time to time you'll see this city come into view through the clouds, and it'll settle down into place and become part of your city for a few hours or days, and then it'll be hoisted back up into the air and go somewhere else.
Well, according to the afterword, people kind of said there's a problem with that, that it would vibrate a lot or something?
Well, I have a friend in Seattle who's very knowledgeable about mathematics and physics, and who actually gave me some particularly useful feedback on an early draft of the book. And I took part of that to heart and incorporated it into the book. But he's still a bit grumpy about the potential for oscillations and vibrations in this whole system, which I've completely ignored.
What have the scientists you've talked to since the book came out, or is it too soon to see what they'd say, hey, this is really cool, we never thought of this, or nice idea, but forget it?
The thing is that most scientists, or not most, but a lot of scientists are science fiction fans. They've been reading science fiction their whole lives. On the one hand, they want it to be scientifically accurate. On the other hand, they get it. They know that there's room for some creative license. They know that Star Trek, for example, and Star Wars are completely preposterous on any number of levels scientifically, and they enjoy those things anyhow. So they're able to kind of dial that up and down. And in this case, you know, I'm trying to be a little more faithful to scientific reality than some of those others. And they have helped me do that. I've gotten some great feedback from people like that. They have enough understanding to realize that it's not going to be 100% realistic.
What would have been an idea that you had that you threw out there and they said, hey, Stevenson, you're really onto something?
Really a good idea?
Yeah.
Oh, well, you know, most of the good ideas have been come up with a long time ago. Because so many smart people have been obsessed with space and space travel for so long that it's almost impossible to come up with a really new idea in this area. So I gave up trying to do that a long time ago. I think there's a few things in this that might be worth further investigation, but the way that it normally goes is that everyone's excited about a new idea until someone points out, hey, here's a showstopper, here's a reason why this couldn't possibly work. And the ideas I've contributed here haven't been through that level of scrutiny yet.
What is Cimarronin?
Cimarronin is a graphic novel, a series, of which I'm one of four co-authors. So the other three co-authors are Mark Teppo, who's a novelist in Seattle, and Charles Mann, who's a well-known author of books about history and science, and Ellis Amdur, who is a psychologist and a martial artist in Seattle, and also the author of a number of books about martial arts. Where this came from is that Charles Mann was working on his book 1493 a few years ago, which was about what happened when the old and new worlds came together. One of the anecdotes he was relating was that in Mexico, there were very rich silver mines, and China was hungry for that silver. And so the silver coming out of those mines would be caravaned down to Acapulco and put on great ships and sent to Manila, where it would be kind of injected into the Chinese economy. And that was kind of a mainstay of the world economy for a long time. Well, there were bands of bandits called Cimarrones who were a mix of Native American peoples and of Africans. There were slaves who had been brought over from Africa and who had escaped and gone up into remote places and sort of formed new social organizations with Indians up there. They were in the habit of raiding the silver caravans, and they were really causing serious problems for the Spanish. And so the Spanish, who at that point had a vast global empire, began trying to find people who could fight these people. And at the time, there happened to be a lot of Ronin, of Japanese sort of exiled samurai, hanging around Manila because the borders of Japan had been sealed by the shogun. Nobody who was outside the country could go back to it under pain of death. And so these guys were working as bouncers and mercenaries and muscle all around Southeast Asia. So it is a real historical fact that the Spaniards actually brought some of these Ronin across the Pacific to Mexico to fight these combined bands of Indian and African bandits. And Charles was writing about that, and he had written a sentence that went something like, so Japanese samurai wielded their katanas in defense of the Spanish Empire's silver. And Charles is an extraordinarily meticulous and conscientious writer, and a little alarm bell had gone off in his head, and he had said, well, I think katana is the right word. I assume they use katanas, but maybe that's just me perpetuating a stereotype, you know. Maybe I should sort of check in with somebody who knows. And he thought I would know, which I didn't. It's very flattering. But I forwarded his communication to Ellis, who would know. And Ellis answered the question, but he and I and Charles were all thinking the same thing, which was this would be an amazing graphic novel. And we brought Mark Teppo in, who contributed on the story level as well as being our guy for panelizing the story, and went to work on that. I actually, just while I was sitting here getting ready for this interview, I saw an email from Ellis that the cover art for the sixth and last issue just came through, so I need to look at that and make comments on it. Most of it's out electronically. It'll all be out electronically soon, and then hopefully we'll be able to get a paper edition of it out in the reasonably near future.
It almost feels like a Quentin Tarantino fever dream.
Yeah, it's too good to be true from that standpoint, and we've tried to do justice to it. So we've got a Ronin and a Spanish guy who are kind of the first two characters you see, and it's a little bit of a buddy road movie. These guys have known each other for a long time, and then there's a Manchu woman and an African guy who kind of complete the ensemble. So it's those are the four main characters.
A couple of quick questions. What is Magic Leap?
Magic Leap is a tech company in Florida with offices in other places that is building an augmented reality system, which is to say a head-mounted thing that you could wear that would project imagery into your visual field without blocking your view of the real world. So if you're sitting in your living room or whatever, you can see what's around you, but you can also see other stuff that's supplied by this system. So I work for them as kind of their chief futurist.
Neal Stephenson, at the end of Seven Eves, and by the way, the title becomes self-evident about halfway through the book, there seems to be a hint that there could easily be two more books about this particular world.
Almost all fantasy and science fiction is about world building, right? And your success, your skill as a fantasy or science fiction writer is really kind of judged by how well you build worlds. Once you've built a world, then you can tell stories in it. You can tell lots of stories. You can go on telling stories for the rest of your life if you want. So this fits into that category. It's a world big enough to tell lots of stories in. And I think one measure of whether you've done it right is that when people get to the end of any given book in that universe, they say, hey, wait a second, you know, I'd like to see what happens next, or I'd like to go back and I'd like to hear more about this minor character, you know, who put in an appearance on page 321 or what have you. So this is one of those. It's always a possibility to do more with something like this, and it's all going to depend on a lot of things I can't predict right now.
Well, you know the two different books that I'm talking about specifically. Well, I mean, The Diggers and The Pingers.
Oh, yeah. And there's more beyond that, right? So yeah.
You said you were working on three books. I guess one is the book that you put aside that you mentioned. What are the other two?
These are all too early to really talk about, but I kind of have a couple of them stacked up like planes above SFO on a foggy morning, waiting for their turn to come in and land.
Well, Neal Stephenson, when I went to IMDb, you know, you were there a few times as a futurist. Has there ever been any interest from Hollywood or elsewhere to convert any of your books into film or TV shows?
In 1984, so more than 30 years ago, my first novel, The Big U, was optioned by Ridley Scott. And almost everything I've written since then has gone through some amount of interaction with Hollywood, an option or buying the rights or working on a TV idea. And that's not an unusual story. That's true of a lot of people. I mean, there's always stuff in the works. There's a couple of things kind of rattling around now. Some of them have been in the works for 20 years.
Neal Stephenson, one final question. you know, and I've asked this question of other authors as well, which is that when you finish a book, particularly a very large book, somehow, as an author, you're sort of changed. Something changes in you. You've either gotten rid of something or something else has come up. In Seven Eves, when you walk away from it, what do you walk away with?
This is going to sound terrible, but I'm sort of like the guy in the Tarantino movie who crashes the car and just walks away from it. I get these things out. I send them off. I tend to be somewhat negligent of them afterwards. I'm trying to change that, so we're trying to add more illustrations, some concept art for Seven Eves. We're trying to get a website going and that sort of thing. But I was sort of came from an era when your final act was to wrap the physical typed manuscript up in old Safeway bags and tape it up and go to the mailbox and heave it in. And there would be this loud thud as you heard it hitting the bottom of the mailbox. You turn your back on it, you walk away, you're done. I'm sure that you're right and that there's all kinds of profound psychological things happening at that moment. But for me, it's always been, okay, done. What's the next project going to be?
There's a picture of the cradle. Is that picture pretty accurate to what was in your mind?
The illustrations are from Weta Workshop in New Zealand, and the whole point of bringing those guys in is that they're just going to do it better than I could.
You've been listening to an interview with Neal Stephenson, whose latest novel is Seven Eves. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves.